This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure, by Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt. This is Jonathan Haidt. We have created a website to go along with the book. Please visit www.thecoddling.com. The site will be particularly useful for those listening to the audiobook because we have posted there a bunch of materials that are hard to convey through the spoken word. For example, you'll find a page with all of the graphs and images, another page with all of the endnotes, including clickable links, and another page with all of the references, the books and articles that we cite. Please do check it out, maybe even before you finish listening to this audiobook. Three quotations. Prepare the child for the road, not the road for the child. Folk wisdom, origin unknown. Your worst enemy cannot harm you as much as your own thoughts unguarded. But once mastered, no one can help you as much, not even your father or your mother. Buddha, Dhammapada. The line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, The Gulag Archipelago. For Our Mothers, Who Did Their Best to Prepare Us for the Road, Joanna Dalton Lukianoff and Elaine Haidt. Introduction. The Search for Wisdom. This is a book about wisdom and its opposite. The book grows out of a trip that Greg and I took to Greece in August of 2016. We had been writing about some ideas spreading through universities that we thought were harming students and damaging their prospects for creating fulfilling lives. These ideas were, in essence, making students less wise. So we decided to write a book to warn people about these terrible ideas, and we thought we'd start by going on a quest for wisdom ourselves. We both work on college campuses. In recent years, we had heard repeated references to the wisdom of Misoponos, a modern-day oracle who lives in a cave on the north slope of Mount Olympus, where he continues the ancient rites of the cult of Koalamos. We flew to Athens and took a 5-hour train ride to Litokoro, a town at the foot of the mountain. At sunrise the next day, we set off on a trail that Greeks have used for thousands of years to seek communion with their gods. We hiked for 6 hours up a steep and winding path. At noon, we came to a fork in the path where a sign said Misoponos, with an arrow pointing to the right. The main path, off to the left, looked forbidding. It went straight up a narrow ravine, with an ever-present danger of rock slides. The path to Misoponos, in contrast, was smooth, level, and easy, a welcome change. It took us through a pleasant grove of pine and fir trees, across a strong wooden pedestrian bridge, over a deep ravine, and right to the mouth of a large cave. Inside the cave, we saw a strange scene. Misoponos and his assistants had installed one of those take-a-number systems that you sometimes find in sandwich shops. And there was a line of other seekers ahead of us. We took a number, paid the 100 euro fee to have a private audience with the great man, performed the mandatory rituals of purification, and waited. When our turn came, we were ushered into a dimly lit chamber at the back of the cave, where a small spring of water bubbled out from a rock wall and splashed down into a large white marble bowl somewhat reminiscent of a bird bath. Next to the bowl, Misoponos sat in a comfortable chair that appeared to be a bark-a-lounger recliner from the 1970s. We had heard that he spoke English, but we were taken aback when he greeted us in perfect American English with a hint of Long Island. "Come on in, guys. Tell me what you seek." I spoke first. "Oh, wise oracle, we have come seeking wisdom. What are the deepest and greatest of truths?" Greg thought we should be more specific, so he added, "Actually, we're writing a book about wisdom for teenagers, young adults, parents, and educators, and we were kind of hoping that you could boil down your insights into some pithy axioms, ideally three of them, which, if followed, would lead young people to develop wisdom over the course of their lives." Misoponos sat silently with his eyes closed for about 2 minutes. Finally, he opened his eyes and spoke. "This fountain is the spring of Koalamos. Koalamos was a Greek god of wisdom, who is not as well known today as Athena, who gets far too much press in my opinion. But Koalamos has some really good stuff too, if you ask me, which you just did, so let me tell you. I will give you 3 cups of wisdom." He filled a small alabaster cup from the water bowl and handed it to us. We both drank from it and handed it back. "This is the first truth," he said. "What doesn't kill you makes you weaker. So avoid pain, avoid discomfort, avoid all potentially bad experiences." I was surprised. I had written a book called The Happiness Hypothesis, which examined ancient wisdom in light of modern psychology. The book devoted an entire chapter to testing the opposite of the oracle's claim, which was most famously stated by Friedrich Nietzsche, "What doesn't kill me makes me stronger." I thought there must be some mistake. "Excuse me, Your Holiness," I said, "but did you really mean to say weaker? Because I've got quotes from many wisdom traditions saying that pain, setbacks, and even traumatic experiences can make people stronger." "Did I say weaker?" asked Misoponos. "Wait a minute, is it weaker or stronger?" He squeezed his eyes shut as he thought about it, and then opened his eyes and said, "Yes, I'm right. Weaker is what I meant. Bad experiences are terrible. Who would want one? Did you travel all this way to have a bad experience? Of course not. And pain? So many oracles in these mountains sit on the ground 12 hours a day, and what does it get them? Circulation problems and lower back pain. How much wisdom can you dispense when you're thinking about your aches and pains all the time? That's why I got this chair 20 years ago. Why shouldn't I be comfortable?" With clear irritation in his voice, he added, "Can I finish?" "I'm sorry," I said meekly. Misoponos filled the cup again. We drank it. "Second," he continued, "always trust your feelings. Never question them." Now it was Greg's turn to recoil. He had spent years practicing cognitive behavioral therapy, which is based on exactly the opposite advice. Feelings so often mislead us that you can't achieve mental health until you learn to question them and free yourself from some common distortions of reality. But having learned to control his immediate negative reactions, he bit his tongue and said nothing. Misoponos refilled the cup, and we drank again. "Third, life is a battle between good people and evil people." We looked at each other in disbelief. Greg could no longer keep quiet. "Oh, great oracle of Koalamos," he began haltingly, "can you explain that one to us?" "Some people are good," Misoponos said slowly and loudly, as if he thought we hadn't heard him. "And some people are bad." He looked at us pointedly and took a breath. "There's so much evil in the world. Where does it come from?" He paused as if expecting us to answer. We were speechless. "From evil people," he said, clearly exasperated. "It is up to you and the rest of the good people in the world to fight them. You must be warriors for virtue and goodness. You can see how bad and wrong some people are. You must call them out. Assemble a coalition of the righteous and shame the evil ones until they change their ways." I asked, "But don't they think the same about us? How can we know that it is we who are right and they who are wrong?" Misoponos responded tartly, "Have you learned nothing from me today? Trust your feelings. Do you feel that you are right, or do you feel that you are wrong? I feel this interview is over. Get out." There is no Misopanos, and we didn't really travel to Greece to discover these three terrible ideas. We didn't have to. You can find them on college campuses, in high schools, and in many homes. These untruths are rarely taught explicitly. Rather, they are conveyed to young people by the rules, practices, and norms that are imposed on them, often with the best of intentions. This is a book about three great untruths that seem to have spread widely in recent years. 1. The untruth of fragility. What doesn't kill you makes you weaker. 2. The untruth of emotional reasoning. Always trust your feelings. 3. The untruth of us versus them. Life is a battle between good people and evil people. While many propositions are untrue, in order to be classified as a great untruth, an idea must meet three criteria. 1. It contradicts ancient wisdom, ideas found widely in the wisdom literatures of many cultures. 2. It contradicts modern psychological research on well-being. And 3. It harms the individuals and communities who embrace it. We will show how these three great untruths, and the policies and political movements that draw on them, are causing problems for young people, universities, and more generally, liberal democracies. To name just a few of these problems, teen anxiety, depression, and suicide rates have risen sharply in the last few years. The culture on many college campuses has become more ideologically uniform, compromising the ability of scholars to seek truth and of students to learn from a broad range of thinkers. Extremists have proliferated on the far right and the far left, provoking one another to ever deeper levels of hatred. Social media has channeled partisan passions into the creation of a call-out culture. Anyone can be publicly shamed for saying something well-intentioned that someone else interprets uncharitably. New media platforms and outlets allow citizens to retreat into self-confirmatory bubbles, where their worst fears about the evils of the other side can be confirmed and amplified by extremists and cyber trolls intent on sowing discord and division. The three great untruths have flowered on many college campuses, but they have their roots in earlier education and childhood experiences, and they now extend from the campus into the corporate world and the public square, including national politics. They are also spreading outward from American universities to universities throughout the English-speaking world. These great untruths are bad for everyone. Anyone who cares about young people, education, or democracy should be concerned about these trends. The real origins of this book. In May of 2014, Greg and I sat down for lunch together in New York City's Greenwich Village. We were there to talk about a puzzle that Greg had been trying to solve for the past year or two. Greg is a First Amendment lawyer. Since 2001, he has been fighting for academic freedom and freedom of speech on campus as the head of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE. A nonpartisan, nonprofit organization, FIRE is dedicated to defending liberty, freedom of speech, due process, and academic freedom on the country's college campuses. Throughout Greg's career, the calls for campus censorship had generally come from administrators. Students, on the other hand, had always been the one group that consistently supported free speech, in fact, demanded it. But now something was changing. On some campuses, words were increasingly seen as sources of danger. In the fall of 2013, Greg began hearing about students asking for triggering material to be removed from courses. By the spring of 2014, The New Republic and The New York Times were reporting on this trend. Greg also noticed an intensified push from students for school administrators to disinvite speakers whose ideas the students found offensive. When those speakers were not disinvited, students were increasingly using the heckler's veto, protesting in ways that prevented their fellow students from attending the talk or from hearing the speaker. Most concerning to Greg, however, and the reason he wanted to talk to me, was the shift in the justifications for these new reactions to course materials and speakers. In years past, administrators were motivated to create campus speech codes in order to curtail what they deemed to be racist or sexist speech. Increasingly, however, the rationale for speech codes and speaker disinvitations was becoming medicalized. Students claimed that certain kinds of speech, and even the content of some books and courses, interfered with their ability to function. They wanted protection from material that they believed could jeopardize their mental health by triggering them or making them feel unsafe. To give one example, Columbia University's core curriculum, part of the general education requirement for all undergraduates at Columbia College, features a course called Masterpieces of Western Literature and Philosophy. At one point, this included works by Ovid, Homer, Dante, Augustine, Montaigne, and Wolfe. According to the university, the course is supposed to tackle the most difficult questions about human experience. However, in 2015, four Columbia undergraduates wrote an essay in the school newspaper arguing that students need to feel safe in the classroom, but many texts in the Western canon are wrought with histories and narratives of exclusion and oppression, and contain triggering and offensive material that marginalizes student identities in the classroom. Some students said that these texts are so emotionally challenging to read and discuss that professors should issue trigger warnings and provide support for triggered students. Trigger warnings are verbal or written notifications provided by a professor to alert students that they are about to encounter potentially distressing material. The essay was nuanced and made some important points about diversifying the literary canon. But is safety versus danger a helpful framework for discussing reactions to literature? Or might that framework itself alter a student's reactions to ancient texts, creating a feeling of threat and a stress response to what otherwise would have been experienced merely as discomfort or dislike? Of course, student activism is nothing new. Students have been actively trying to shape their learning environment for decades, such as when they joined professors during the Canon Wars of the 1990s, the effort to add more women and writers of color to the lists of dead white males that dominated reading lists. Students in the 1960s and 1970s often tried to keep speakers off campus or prevent speakers from being heard. For example, students at several universities protested lectures by Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson because of his writings about how evolution shaped human behavior, which some students thought could be used to justify existing gender roles and inequalities. A sign advertising one protest urged fellow students to bring noisemakers. But those efforts were not driven by health concerns. Students wanted to block people they thought were espousing evil ideas, as they do today. But back then, they were not saying that members of the school community would be harmed by the speaker's visit or by exposure to ideas. And they were certainly not asking that professors and administrators take a more protective attitude toward them by shielding them from the presence of certain people. What is new today is the premise that students are fragile. Even those who are not fragile themselves often believe that others are in danger and therefore need protection. There is no expectation that students will grow stronger from their encounters with speech or texts they label triggering. This is the untruth of fragility. What doesn't kill you makes you weaker. To Greg, who had suffered from bouts of depression throughout his life, this seemed like a terrible approach. In seeking treatment for his depression, he, along with millions of others around the world, had found that cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, was the most effective solution. CBT teaches you to notice when you are engaging in various cognitive distortions, such as catastrophizing. If I fail this quiz, I'll fail the class and be kicked out of school, and then I'll never get a job. And negative filtering, only paying attention to negative feedback instead of noticing praise as well. These distorted and irrational thought patterns are hallmarks of depression and anxiety disorders. We are not saying that students are never in real physical danger or that their claims about injustice are usually cognitive distortions. We are saying that even when students are reacting to real problems, they are more likely than previous generations to engage in thought patterns that make those problems seem more threatening, which makes them harder to solve. An important discovery by early CBT researchers was that if people learn to stop thinking this way, their depression and anxiety usually subside. For this reason, Greg was troubled when he noticed that some students' reactions to speech on college campuses exhibited exactly the same distortions that he had learned to rebut in his own therapy. Where had students learned these bad mental habits? Wouldn't these cognitive distortions make students more anxious and depressed? Of course, many things have changed on campus since the 1970s. College students today are far more diverse. They arrive on campus having faced varying degrees of bigotry, poverty, trauma, and mental illness. Educators must account for those differences, reevaluate old assumptions, and strive to create an inclusive community. But what is the best way to do that? If we are especially concerned about the students who have faced the most serious obstacles, should our priority be protecting them from speakers, books, and ideas that might offend them? Or might such protective measures, however well-intentioned, backfire and harm those very students? All students must be prepared for the world they will face after college, and those who are making the largest jump, the ones most in danger of feeling like strangers in a strange land, are the ones who must learn fastest and prepare hardest. The playing field is not level, life is not fair, but college is quite possibly the best environment on earth in which to come face to face with people and ideas that are potentially offensive or even downright hostile. It is the ultimate mental gymnasium, full of advanced equipment, skilled trainers, and therapists standing by just in case. Greg worried that if students came to see themselves as fragile, they would stay away from that gym. If students didn't build skills and accept friendly invitations to spar in the practice ring, and if they avoided these opportunities because well-meaning people convinced them that they'd be harmed by such training, well, it would be a tragedy for all concerned. Their beliefs about their own and others' fragility in the face of ideas they dislike would become self-fulfilling prophecies. Not only would students come to believe that they can't handle such things, but if they acted on that belief and avoided exposure, eventually they would become less able to do so. If students succeeded in creating bubbles of intellectual safety in college, they would set themselves up for even greater anxiety and conflict after graduation, when they will certainly encounter many more people with more extreme views. Based on Greg's personal and professional experience, his theory was this: students were beginning to demand protection from speech because they had unwittingly learned to employ the very cognitive distortions that CBT tries to correct. Stated simply, many university students are learning to think in distorted ways, and this increases their likelihood of becoming fragile, anxious, and easily hurt. Greg wanted to discuss this theory with me because I'm a social psychologist who has written extensively about the power of CBT and its close fit with ancient wisdom. I immediately saw the potential in Greg's idea. As a professor at New York University's Stern School of Business, I had just begun to see the first signs of this new fragile student model. My main research area is moral psychology, and my second book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, was an effort to help people understand different moral cultures or moral matrices, particularly the moral cultures of the political left and right. The term matrix, as I used it, comes from the 1984 science fiction novel Neuromancer by William Gibson, which was the inspiration for the later movie The Matrix. Gibson imagined a futuristic, internet-like network linking everyone together. He called it the Matrix and referred to it as a consensual hallucination. I thought it was a great way to think about moral cultures. A group creates a consensual moral matrix as individuals interact with one another, and then they act in ways that may be unintelligible to outsiders. At the time, it seemed to both of us that a new moral matrix was forming in some pockets of universities and was destined to grow. Social media, of course, is perfectly designed to help consensual hallucinations spread within connected communities at warp speed, on campus and off, on the left and on the right. I eagerly agreed to join Greg in his attempt to solve this mystery. We wrote an article together exploring Greg's idea and using it to explain a number of events and trends that had arisen on campus in the previous year or two. We submitted the article to The Atlantic with the title, Arguing Towards Misery, How Campuses Teach Cognitive Distortions. The editor, Don Peck, liked the article, helped us strengthen the argument, and then gave it a more succinct and provocative title, The Coddling of the American Mind. In that article, we argued that many parents, K-12 teachers, professors, and university administrators have been unknowingly teaching a generation of students to engage in the mental habits commonly seen in people who suffer from anxiety and depression. We suggested that students were beginning to react to words, books, and visiting speakers with fear and anger because they had been taught to exaggerate danger, use dichotomous or binary thinking, amplify their first emotional responses, and engage in a number of other cognitive distortions, which we will discuss further throughout this book. Such thought patterns directly harmed students' mental health and interfered with their intellectual development and sometimes the development of those around them. At some schools, a culture of defensive self-censorship seemed to be emerging, partly in response to students who were quick to call out or shame others for small things that they deemed to be insensitive, either to the student doing the calling out or to members of a group that the student was standing up for. We called this pattern vindictive protectiveness and argued that such behavior made it more difficult for all students to have open discussions in which they could practice the essential skills of critical thinking and civil disagreement. Our article was published on The Atlantic's website on August 11, 2015, and the magazine issue that featured it hit newsstands about a week later. We were expecting a wave of criticism, but many people on and off campus and from across the political spectrum had noticed the trends we described, and the initial reception of our essay was overwhelmingly positive. Our piece became one of the 5 most viewed articles of all time on The Atlantic's website, and President Obama even referred to it in a speech a few weeks later when he praised the value of viewpoint diversity and said that students should not be coddled and protected from different points of view. By October, we had finished our media appearances related to the article, and both of us were happy to return to our other work. Little did we know that the coming months and years were about to turn not only the academic world, but the entire country upside down. Also, in 2016, it became clear that the great untruths and their associated practices were spreading to universities in the United Kingdom, Canada, and Australia. So, in the fall of 2016, we decided to take another, harder look at the questions we had raised in the article and write this book. Tumultuous Years, 2015 to 2017. Looking back from early 2018, it's amazing how much has changed since we published that article in August of 2015. A powerful movement for racial justice had already been launched and was gaining strength with each horrific cell phone video of police killing unarmed black men. That fall, protests over issues of racial justice erupted at dozens of campuses around the country, beginning at the University of Missouri and Yale. It was a level of activism not seen on campus in decades. Meanwhile, during this period, mass killings filled the news. Terrorists carried out large-scale attacks across Europe and the Middle East. In the United States, 14 people were killed and more than 20 others injured in an ISIS-inspired shooting in San Bernardino, California. Another ISIS-inspired attack on a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida, became the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history, with 49 people killed. And that number was surpassed just 16 months later in Las Vegas, when a man with what was essentially a machine gun shot and killed 58 people and wounded 851 others at an outdoor concert. And 2016 became one of the strangest years ever in U.S. presidential politics when Donald Trump, a candidate with no prior political experience, who had been widely regarded as unelectable because of the many groups of people he had offended, not only won the Republican primary, but won the election. Millions turned out across the country to protest his inauguration, cross-partisan hatred surged, and the news cycle came to revolve around the president's latest tweet or latest comment about nuclear war. Attention returned to campus protests in the spring of 2017 as violence broke out at Middlebury College and, on a scale not seen in decades, at the University of California, Berkeley, where self-described anti-fascists caused hundreds of thousands of dollars of damage to the campus and the town, injuring students and others. 6 months later, neo-Nazis and Ku Klux Klansmen marched with torches across the grounds of the University of Virginia, one day before a white nationalist drove his car into a crowd of counter-protesters, killing one of them and injuring others. The year ended with the Me Too movement, as many women began to publicly share their stories of sexual misconduct and assault, stories that turned out to be common in professions dominated by powerful men. In this environment, practically anyone of any age and at any point on the political spectrum could make the case for being anxious, depressed, or outraged. Isn't this a sufficient explanation for the unrest and new demands for safety on campus? Why return to the issues we raised in our original Atlantic article? Coddling means overprotecting. We have always been ambivalent about the word coddling. We didn't like the implication that children today are pampered, spoiled, and lazy, because that is not accurate. Young people today, at a minimum those who are competing for places at selective colleges, are under enormous pressure to perform academically and to build up a long list of extracurricular accomplishments. Meanwhile, all teens face new forms of harassment, insult, and social competition from social media. Their economic prospects are uncertain in an economy being reshaped by globalization, automation, and artificial intelligence, and characterized by wage stagnation for most workers. So most kids don't have easy, pampered childhoods. But, as we'll show in this book, adults are doing far more these days to protect children, and their overreach might be having some negative effects. Dictionary definitions of coddle emphasize this overprotection. For example, to treat with extreme or excessive care or kindness. The fault lies with adults and with institutional practices, hence our subtitle, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. That is exactly what this book is about. We will show how well-intentioned overprotection, from peanut bans in elementary schools through speech codes on college campuses, may end up doing more harm than good. But overprotection is just one part of a larger trend that we call problems of progress. This term refers to bad consequences produced by otherwise good social changes. It's great that our economic system produces an abundance of food at low prices, but the flip side is an epidemic of obesity. It's great that we can connect and communicate with people instantly and for free, but this hyperconnection may be damaging the mental health of young people. It's great that we have refrigerators, antidepressants, air conditioning, hot and cold running water, and the ability to escape from most of the physical hardships that were woven into the daily lives of our ancestors back to the dawn of our species. Comfort and physical safety are boons to humanity, but they bring some costs too. We adapt to our new and improved circumstances and then lower the bar for what we count as intolerable levels of discomfort and risk. By the standards of our great-grandparents, nearly all of us are coddled. Each generation tends to see the one after it as weak, whiny, and lacking in resilience. Those older generations may have a point, even though these generational changes reflect real and positive progress. To repeat, we are not saying that the problems facing students and young people more generally are minor or all in their heads. We are saying that what people choose to do in their heads will determine how those real problems affect them. Our argument is ultimately pragmatic, not moralistic. Whatever your identity, background, or political ideology, you will be happier, healthier, stronger, and more likely to succeed in pursuing your own goals if you do the opposite of what Misoponos advised. That means seeking out challenges, rather than eliminating or avoiding everything that feels unsafe. Freeing yourself from cognitive distortions, rather than always trusting your initial feelings. And taking a generous view of other people and looking for nuance, rather than assuming the worst about people within a simplistic us versus them morality. What we will do in this book. The story we tell is not simple, and while there are some heroes, there are no clear villains. Our tale is, rather, a social science detective story in which the crime was committed by a confluence of social trends and forces. Surprising events began happening on college campuses around 2013 and 2014, and they became stranger and more frequent between 2015 and 2017. In part one of the book, we set the stage. We give you the intellectual tools you'll need to make sense of the new culture of safety that has swept across many college campuses since 2013. Those tools include learning to recognize the three great untruths. Along the way, we'll explain some of the key concepts of cognitive behavioral therapy, and we'll show how CBT improves critical thinking skills while counteracting the effects of the great untruths. In part two, we show the great untruths in action. We examine the shoutdowns, intimidation, and occasional violence that are making it more difficult for universities to fulfill their core missions of education and research. We explore the newly popular idea that speech is violence, and we show why thinking this way is bad for students' mental health. We explore the sociology of witch hunts and moral panics, including the conditions that can cause a college to descend into chaos. In part three, we try to solve the mystery. Why did things change so rapidly on many campuses between 2013 and 2017? We identify six explanatory threads. 1. The rising political polarization and cross-party animosity of U.S. politics, which has led to rising hate crimes and harassment on campus. 2. Rising levels of teen anxiety and depression, which have made many students more desirous of protection and more receptive to the great untruths. 3. Changes in parenting practices, which have amplified children's fears even as childhood becomes increasingly safe. 4. The loss of free play and unsupervised risk-taking, both of which kids need to become self-governing adults. 5. The growth of campus bureaucracy and expansion of its protective mission. And 6. An increasing passion for justice, combined with changing ideas about what justice requires. These six trends did not influence everyone equally, but they have all begun to intersect and interact on college campuses in the United States in the last few years. Finally, in part four, we offer advice. We suggest specific actions that will help parents and teachers to raise wiser, stronger, more independent children, and we suggest ways in which professors, administrators, and college students can improve their universities and adapt them for life in our age of technology-enhanced outrage. In 2014, we set out to understand what was happening on U.S. college campuses, but the story we tell in this book is about far more than that. It's the story of our strange and unsettling time when many institutions are malfunctioning, trust is declining, and a new generation, the one after the millennials, is just beginning to graduate from college and enter the workforce. Our story ends on a hopeful note. The problems we describe may be temporary. we believe they are fixable. The arc of history bends toward progress on most measures of health, prosperity, and freedom. But if we can understand the six explanatory threads and free ourselves from the three great untruths, it may bend a little faster. Part 1, Three Bad Ideas. Chapter 1, The Untruth of Fragility. What doesn't kill you makes you weaker. A quotation from Meng Tzu, 4th century BCE. When heaven is about to confer a great responsibility on any man, it will exercise his mind with suffering, subject his sinews and bones to hard work, expose his body to hunger, put him to poverty, place obstacles in the paths of his deeds so as to stimulate his mind, harden his nature, and improve wherever he is incompetent. In August 2009, Max Height, age 3, had his first day of preschool in Charlottesville, Virginia. But before he was allowed to take the first step on his 18-year journey to a college degree, his parents, Jane and I, had to attend a mandatory orientation session where the rules and procedures were explained by Max's teacher. The most important rule, judging by the time spent discussing it, was no nuts. Because of the risk to children with peanut allergies, there was an absolute prohibition on bringing anything containing nuts into the building. Of course, peanuts are legumes, not nuts. But some kids have allergies to tree nuts too, so, along with peanuts and peanut butter, all nuts and nut products were banned. And to be extra safe, the school also banned anything produced in a factory that processes nuts, so many kinds of dried fruits and other snacks were prohibited too. As the list of prohibited substances grew, and as the clock ticked on, I asked the assembled group of parents what I thought was a helpful question. Does anyone here have a child with any kind of nut allergy? If we know about the kid's actual allergies, I'm sure we'll all do everything we can to avoid risk. But if there's no kid in the class with such an allergy, then maybe we can lighten up a bit, and instead of banning all those things, just ban peanuts. The teacher was visibly annoyed by my question, and she moved rapidly to stop any parent from responding. Don't put anyone on the spot, she said. Don't make any parent feel uncomfortable. Regardless of whether anyone in the class is affected, these are the school's rules. You can't blame the school for being so cautious. Peanut allergies were rare among American children up until the mid-1990s, when one study found that only 4 out of 1,000 children under the age of 8 had such an allergy, meaning probably nobody in Max's entire preschool of about 100 kids. But by 2008, according to the same survey using the same measures, the rate had more than tripled to 14 out of 1,000, meaning probably 1 or 2 kids in Max's school. Nobody knew why American children were suddenly becoming more allergic to peanuts, but the logical and compassionate response was obvious. Kids are vulnerable. Protect them from peanuts, peanut products, and anything that has been in contact with nuts of any kind. Why not? What's the harm, other than some inconvenience to parents preparing lunches? But it turns out that the harm was severe. It was later discovered that peanut allergies were surging precisely because parents and teachers had started protecting children from exposure to peanuts back in the 1990s. In February 2015, an authoritative study was published. The LEAP study, Learning Early About Peanut Allergy, was based on the hypothesis that, quote, regular eating of peanut-containing products, when started during infancy, will elicit a protective immune response instead of an allergic immune reaction, end quote. The researchers recruited the parents of 640 infants, 4 to 11 months old, who were at high risk of developing a peanut allergy because they had severe eczema or had tested positive for another allergy. The researchers told half the parents to follow the standard advice for high-risk kids, which was to avoid all exposure to peanuts and peanut products. The other half were given a supply of a snack made from peanut butter and puffed corn, and were told to give some to their child at least 3 times a week. The researchers followed all the families carefully, and when the children turned 5 years old, They were tested for an allergic reaction to peanuts. The results were stunning. Among the children who had been protected from peanuts, 17% had developed a peanut allergy. In the group that had been deliberately exposed to peanut products, only 3% had developed an allergy. As one of the researchers said in an interview, "For decades, allergists have been recommending that young infants avoid consuming allergenic foods such as peanut to prevent food allergies. Our findings suggest that this advice was incorrect and may have contributed to the rise in the peanut and other food allergies." It makes perfect sense. The immune system is a miracle of evolutionary engineering. It can't possibly anticipate all the pathogens and parasites a child will encounter, especially in a mobile and omnivorous species such as ours. So it is designed by natural selection to learn rapidly from early experience. The immune system is a complex adaptive system, which can be defined as a dynamic system that is able to adapt in and evolve with a changing environment. It requires exposure to a range of foods, bacteria, and even parasitic worms in order to develop its ability to mount an immune response to real threats, such as the bacterium that causes strep throat, while ignoring non-threats, such as peanut proteins. Vaccination uses the same logic. Childhood vaccines make us healthier not by reducing threats in the world, ban germs in schools, but by exposing children to those threats in small doses, thereby giving children's immune systems the opportunity to learn how to fend off similar threats in the future. This is the underlying rationale for what is called the hygiene hypothesis, the leading explanation for why allergy rates generally go up as countries get wealthier and cleaner, another example of a problem of progress. Developmental psychologist Alison Gopnik explains the hypothesis succinctly and does us the favor of linking it to our mission in this book. Thanks to hygiene, antibiotics, and too little outdoor play, children don't get exposed to microbes as they once did. This may lead them to develop immune systems that overreact to substances that aren't actually threatening, causing allergies. In the same way, by shielding children from every possible risk, we may lead them to react with exaggerated fear to situations that aren't risky at all, and isolate them from the adult skills that they will one day have to master. End quote. This brings us to the Oracle's first great untruth, the untruth of fragility. What doesn't kill you makes you weaker. Of course, Nietzsche's original aphorism, "What doesn't kill me makes me stronger," is not entirely correct if taken literally. Some things that don't kill you can still leave you permanently damaged and diminished. But teaching kids that failures, insults, and painful experiences will do lasting damage is harmful in and of itself. Human beings need physical and mental challenges and stressors, or we deteriorate. For example, muscles and joints need stressors to develop properly. Too much rest causes muscles to atrophy, joints to lose range of motion, heart and lung function to decline, and blood clots to form. Without the challenges imposed by gravity, astronauts develop muscle weakness and joint degeneration. Antifragility. No one has done a better job of explaining the harm of avoiding stressors, risks, and small doses of pain than Nassim Nicholas Taleb, the Lebanese-born statistician, stock trader, and polymath, who is now a professor of risk engineering at New York University. In his 2007 bestseller, The Black Swan, Taleb argued that most of us think about risk in the wrong way. In complex systems, it is virtually inevitable that unforeseen problems will arise, yet we persist in trying to calculate risk based on past experiences. Life has a way of creating completely unexpected events. Events Taleb likens to the appearance of a black swan when, based on your past experience, you assumed that all swans were white. Taleb was one of the few who predicted the global financial crisis of 2008 based on the financial system's vulnerability to black swan events. In his later book, Antifragile, Taleb explains how systems and people can survive the inevitable black swans of life and, like the immune system, grow stronger in response. Taleb asks us to distinguish three kinds of things. Some, like china teacups, are fragile. They break easily and cannot heal themselves, so you must handle them gently and keep them away from toddlers. Other things are resilient. They can withstand shocks. Parents usually give their toddlers plastic cups precisely because plastic can survive repeated falls to the floor, although the cups do not benefit from such falls. But Taleb asks us to look beyond the overused word resilience and recognize that some things are anti-fragile. Many of the important systems in our economic and political life are like our immune systems. They require stressors and challenges in order to learn, adapt, and grow. Systems that are anti-fragile become rigid, weak, and inefficient when nothing challenges them or pushes them to respond vigorously. He notes that muscles, bones, and children are anti-fragile. Quote, "Just as spending a month in bed leads to muscle atrophy, complex systems are weakened, even killed, when deprived of stressors. Much of our modern, structured world has been harming us with top-down policies and contraptions which do precisely this, an insult to the anti-fragility of systems. This is the tragedy of modernity. As with neurotically overprotective parents, those trying to help are often hurting us the most." End quote. Taleb opens the book with a poetic image that should speak to all parents. He notes that wind extinguishes a candle but energizes a fire. He advises us not to be like candles and not to turn our children into candles. Quote, "You want to be the fire and wish for the wind." End quote. The foolishness of overprotection is apparent as soon as you understand the concept of antifragility. Given that risks and stressors are natural, unavoidable parts of life, parents and teachers should be helping kids develop their innate abilities to grow and learn from such experiences. There's an old saying, prepare the child for the road, not the road for the child. But these days, we seem to be doing precisely the opposite. We're trying to clear away anything that might upset children, not realizing that in doing so, we're repeating the peanut allergy mistake. If we protect children from various classes of potentially upsetting experiences, we make it far more likely that those children will be unable to cope with such events when they leave our protective umbrella. The modern obsession with protecting young people from feeling unsafe is, we believe, one of the several causes of the rapid rise in rates of adolescent depression, anxiety, and suicide, which we'll explore in Chapter 7. The rise of safetyism. In the 20th century, the word safety generally meant physical safety. A great triumph of the late part of that century was that the United States became physically safer for children. As a result of class action lawsuits, efforts by investigative journalists and consumer advocates such as Ralph Nader, and common sense, dangerous products and practices became less prevalent. Between 1978 and 1985, all 50 states passed laws making the use of car seats mandatory for children. Homes and daycare centers were childproofed. Choking hazards and sharp objects were removed. As a result, death rates for children have plummeted. This is, of course, a very good thing, although in some other ways, the focus on physical safety may have gone too far. The Alison Gopnik essay quoted above was titled, "Should We Let Toddlers Play with Saws and Knives?" Her answer was, maybe. But gradually, in the 21st century, on some college campuses, the meaning of safety underwent a process of concept creep and expanded to include emotional safety. As an example, in 2014, Oberlin College posted guidelines for faculty urging them to use trigger warnings to, quote, "show students that you care about their safety," end quote. The rest of the memo makes it clear that what the college was really telling its faculty was, show students that you care about their feelings. You can see the conflation of safety and feelings in another part of the memo, which urged faculty to use each student's preferred gender pronoun. For example, she or they for students who don't want to be referred to as he or she. Not because this was respectful or appropriately sensitive, but because a professor who uses an incorrect pronoun, quote, prevents or impairs their safety in a classroom, end quote. If students have been told that they can request gender-neutral pronouns, and then a professor fails to use one, students may be disappointed or upset. But are these students unsafe? Are students in any danger in a classroom if a professor uses the wrong pronoun? Professors should indeed be mindful of their students' feelings, but how might it change Oberlin students and the nature of class discussions when the community is told repeatedly that they should judge the speech of others in terms of safety and danger? To understand how an Oberlin administrator could have used the word safety, we turn to an article published in 2016 by the Australian psychologist Nick Haslam, titled Concept Creep, Psychology's Expanding Concepts of Harm and Pathology. Haslam examined a variety of key concepts in clinical and social psychology, including abuse, bullying, trauma, and prejudice, to determine how their usage had changed since the 1980s. He found that their scope had expanded in two directions. The concepts had crept downward to apply to less severe situations, and outward to encompass new but conceptually related phenomena. Take the word trauma. In the early versions of the Primary Manual of Psychiatry, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM, psychiatrists used the word trauma only to describe a physical agent causing physical damage, as in the case of what we now call traumatic brain injury. In the 1980 revision, however, the manual, DSM-3, recognized post-traumatic stress disorder as a mental disorder, the first type of traumatic injury that isn't physical. PTSD is caused by an extraordinary and terrifying experience. And the criteria for a traumatic event that warrants a diagnosis of PTSD were and are strict. To qualify, an event would have to evoke significant symptoms of distress in almost everyone and be outside the range of usual human experience. The DSM-3 emphasized that the event was not based on a subjective standard. It had to be something that would cause most people to have a severe reaction. War, rape, and torture were included in this category. Divorce and simple bereavement, as in the death of a spouse due to natural causes, on the other hand, were not, because they are normal parts of life, even if unexpected. These experiences are sad and painful, but pain is not the same thing as trauma. People in these situations that don't fall into the trauma category might benefit from counseling, but they generally recover from such losses without any therapeutic interventions. In fact, even most people who do have traumatic experiences recover completely without intervention. By the early 2000s, however, the concept of trauma within parts of the therapeutic community had crept down so far that it included anything, quote, experienced by an individual as physically or emotionally harmful, with lasting adverse effects on the individual's functioning and mental, physical, social, emotional, or spiritual well-being, end quote. The subjective experience of harm became definitional in assessing trauma. As a result, the word trauma became much more widely used, not just by mental health professionals, but by their clients and patients, including increasing numbers of college students. As with trauma, a key change for most of the concepts Haslam examined was the shift to a subjective standard. It was not for anyone else to decide what counted as trauma, bullying, or abuse. If it felt like that to you, trust your feelings. If a person reported that an event was traumatic or bullying or abusive, his or her subjective assessment was increasingly taken as sufficient evidence. And if a rapidly growing number of students have been diagnosed with a mental disorder, as we'll see in Chapter 7, then there is a rapidly growing need for the campus community to protect them. Safe spaces. Few Americans had ever heard of a safe space, in an academic sense, until March of 2015, when the New York Times published an essay by Judith Shulevitz about a safe space created by students at Brown University. The students were preparing for an upcoming debate between two feminist authors, Wendy McElroy and Jessica Valenti, on rape culture, the concept that prevailing social attitudes